Today, our speaker is Tom Gibnish. He's from Botany, and he's going to be talking about evolution of the monocots.
Yes, thanks very much, Andy. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be contributing to the discussion at this end of the room as opposed to the one I usually contribute on. Monocots, with roughly 65,000 species, 82 families, and 12 orders, and including such groups as grasses, sedges, bromeliads, palms, gingers, bananas, orchids, irises, onions, lilies, yams, pondweeds, aroids, and seagrasses are one of the most diverse, morphologically varied, ecologically successful, and economically important of the early divergent clades of angiosperms. Since they arose in the early Cretaceous, monocots have radiated into almost every habitat on Earth. Today they dominate many terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems, display kaleidoscopic variation in vegetative and floral morphology, provide the basis for most of the human diet, support a huge horticultural industry, include large numbers of endangered taxa, and comprise nearly one quarter of all species and families of flowering plants. Understanding their origin, phylogeny, and patterns of morphological divergence, geographic diversification, and ecological radiation is thus a major challenge and opportunity for evolutionary biologists. Today, I'd like to tell you about three studies of monocot evolution. The first uses next-generation sequencing to address broad-scale relationships across monocots that have proven recalcitrant to previous approaches, and the implications of our findings for repeated origins of wind pollinations in the order Poales. The second analyzes patterns of adaptive radiation, historical biogeography, and rates of net species diversification in the family Bromeliaceae, sister to all other members of the order Poales, and one of the largest families to evolve the epiphytic habit. Finally, I'll outline the first new steps of a new study of adaptive radiation and geographic spread in the lilies of North America. The group that first inspired me while advising one of my students nearly 30 years ago to question how rigorous studies of adaptive radiation might be conducted. So first, to broad-scale patterns of monocot evolution. Over the past 15 years, molecular systematics has revolutionized our understanding of monocot relationships. Such studies involving an international cadre of researchers with many contributions by Mark Chase and his collaborators have already led to a dramatic reclassification of monocots with an ever-increasing understanding of relationships within and among the 12 orders currently recognized. Triumphs of monocot molecular systematics have included, first and foremost, the recognition of the so-called comilinid clade, including the order Poales, the grasses, sedges, bromeliads, and their allies, the order Comilinales, the dayflowers, water hyacinths, and relatives, the order Zingiberales, the gingers, bananas, Heliconias and related tropical monocots, the order Ericales, the palms, and the Australian woody dasypogonids. This finding was buttressed by Paula Rudall's demonstration that all five of these groups share UV fluorescent ferulic acid in their cell walls, despite their otherwise great divergence, and relationships to each other that have remained enigmatic until just now. Other key advances have included the validation of most of the orders recognized by Dahlgren based on morphology, and the discovery that several genera originally placed in one order, Liliales, based on morphology, actually belong to a total of four different orders. Perhaps most remarkably, Sorella and colleagues recently shown that highly reduced members of the aquatic family Hydatalaceae are not, as had long been believed, members of Poales, and indeed not even monocots, and are instead sister to water lilies and other members of order Nymphiales, one of the earliest divergent clades of angiosperms. The emerging molecular phylogeny, which I don't expect you to read all the details of, places Acarus sister to all the other monocots, followed by divergence of the orders Elismatales, Petrosaviales, Dioscoriales, and Pandanales, then Liliales, then Asparagales, and finally the Comilinid orders. relationships among the lilioid monocots, which were really previously quite baffling, have been greatly clarified. But as this slide indicates, even the most comprehensive approach taken to date, including analyses of 125 monocots, including all families, and using 7 genes for the classic mitochondrial nuclear genomes, leave many relationships unresolved or, as indicated by the red or yellow branches, weakly supported. Examples include the ties among the 5 orders of the colonates on the left, relationships among many, if not most, of the families within the poales in the leftmost portion of the slide, positions of asparagales and lilioales relative to the colonates, affinities of several families within asparagales and zingiberales, and identification of sister groups to the 2 largest groups of monocots, the grasses over on the left extreme and the orchids in the middle. Previous studies on monocot phylogeny have made substantial progress, but much remains to be learned, perhaps because so many groups appear to have diverged from each other more than 90 million years ago, leaving only subtle traces of deep relationships in their current form and DNA. In addition, while molecular data resolve and strongly support several monocot clades, many clades lack known morphological synapomorphies, if you will, field marks, by which they and close relatives in the fossil record can be diagnosed. Finally, the current multi-gene phylogenies for monocots include too few taxa, only 75 to 125 species, to allow powerful analyses of several interesting questions involving context-specific adaptation or speciation and extinction rates, or biogeographic history across the monocots. A few years ago, when my colleagues and I tested whether, as I had predicted long ago on a priori functional grounds, net venation and fleshy fruits show concerted convergence with both traits evolving repeatedly when lineages invade shady habitats indicated by the sand-colored boxes on the slide. We had to develop and rely on a phylogeny based on a single plastid gene, NDHF, in order to extend our analyses to nearly 300 species that we needed to adequately sample morphological and ecological diversity across the monocots. Although this study provided many important new insights, it was limited by uncertainties in the resolution of the monocot phylogeny, particularly at the deeper nodes. Therefore, in order to develop a better understanding of broad-scale relationships in monocots and a stronger basis for analyzing patterns of morphological, developmental, ecological, and geographic differentiation in this group, my colleagues and I obtained funding from NSF's A2L, or Assembling the Tree of Life program, for our 5-year intensive study of monocot evolution, building on the strong foundation of the past 15 years of research by the international botanical community. Our aims are to first develop a fully resolved, strongly supported, highly inclusive broad-scale phylogeny for the monocots based on sequencing transcriptomes of young leaf tissue for 50 to 100 species and sequencing whole placid genomes and targeted mitochondrial and nuclear genes for roughly 200 species representing all the monocot families and most subfamilies. We'll also score more than 200 morphological characters for the same set of extant species and 75 fossil taxa. We'll reassess the stratigraphy and classification of several fossil monocots and develop a new timeline for monocot evolution. We'll identify morphological synapomorphies to permit diagnosis of all major monocot clades. We'll use the emerging phylogeny to conduct broad-scale analyses of morphological, developmental, ecological, and biogeographic evolution. And we will help train a new generation of monocot investigators in phylogenetics, genomics, and classification. Shown, by the way, in the upper left is Mercedes Ames, who's making invaluable contributions to this project through her sequencing of plastomes. All right, now as a central part of this overall effort, we will ultimately sequence and analyze hundreds of whole plastid genomes, also known as plastomes. Almost all studies to date using DNA to infer relationships among monocots or other angiosperms have been phylogenetic, relying on sequences of one or a few genes or gene spacers or introns. Our approach will be predominantly phylogenomic, providing sequences for ultimately for more than 100 chloroplast genes, introns, and spacers, and generating an avalanche of new data with which to assess evolutionary relationships. Now, in sequencing plastomes and targeted mitochondrial and nuclear genes, we've collaborated extensively with members of the angiosperm A2L team, led by Doug Soltis and including Ken Seitzman over on the left side of the room. They've already sequenced more than 30 plastomes and several mitochondrial and nuclear genes for monocot outgroups. We're also coordinating our efforts with the European Monocot Initiative, led by Vincent Savalainen, and which is aimed at sequencing two plastid genes for representatives of all 2,400 monocot genera. So these efforts are complementary in terms of taxonomic coverage for the angiosperm A2L and in resolving deep monocot nodes, while the Europeans link our backbone phylogeny for 200 genera to the remaining 1,800 genera of monocots. Now, based on next generation DNA sequencing by synthesis, using 454 and Illumina technologies, over the past 18 months, we and our colleagues have obtained 50 new plastome sequences for monocots, representing 11 of 12 orders and 32 of 82 families, complementing an extensive set of such sequences for non-monocots produced by Bob Janssen and colleagues and by the angiosperm A2L team. Our maximum likelihood analysis of 81 aligned plastid genes, including over 109,000 bases, aligned bases for 63 monocots and 18 non-monocots, and using Amberella as an outgroup, produced a single fully resolved tree. All nodes among the non-monocots, which are off the bottom of this monocot portion of the tree, had 100% bootstrap. Within the monocots, 53 of 62 nodes had 100% bootstrap support, and all but five nodes had 95% bootstrap support or higher. Within the monocots, as you can see at the bottom, Acarus was sister to all other taxa, as has been in almost all broad-scale phylogenetic studies of monocot relationships over the past 15 years. All six monocot orders represented by more than one species were resolved as being monophyletic with 100% bootstrap support. There really weren't any surprises at the deeper nodes, where our sampling to date has been substantially sparser than in Asparagales and the commelinid orders, especially Poales, that are the focus of this study. As expected, Asparagales is sister to the five commelinid orders, and Liliales is sister to both. Among the commelinids, plastome data make a critical contribution in resolving for the first time, with strong statistical support, relationships among the five component orders. As with all recent studies, Commelinales and Zingiberales are retrieved as being sister to each other. Oopsie, let's bring that back. See that the blue circle indicates those two orders. And what's new is that this clade of Zingiberales and Commelinales is sister to Poales, the other herbaceous commelinid order, with 93% bootstrap support. And that the two woody commelinid orders, the palms, or Aracales and Dasypogonids, circled as in a green ellipse there, are resolved as sister to each other and as a group sister to the herbaceous commelinids with an 86% bootstrap support. The extremely short branches linking Poales to Commelinales and Zingiberales and Aracales to Dasypogonales attests to why the resolution of relationships among the convoluted orders has proven until now the most challenging question in higher level monarchon systematics. Interestingly, members of our A2L team have found the same pattern of relationships among the convoluted orders by analyzing sequence variation in the single copy nuclear gene Phi-C, as well as four placid genes, two mitochondrial genes, and one nuclear ribosomal gene. Our resolution of relationships among the convoluteds conflicts with those found with, by the way, much weaker support by Mark Chase et al. In 2006, based on the same data set, but minus Phi-C. Chase et al. Inferred that the dasypogonids were sister to the Poalias, and that clade was sister to the Commelinalias, Zingiberalias. The palms were sister to all. In contrast, using 17 plastic genes and spacers, Sean Graham and his colleagues found that palms were sister to Poalias, and dasypogonids sister to the Commelinalias and Zingiberalias. So I think we're getting very close to seeing all possible patterns of relationship there, but again, our results are the only one with strong statistical support. Now, although our plastome findings are supported by more data per taxon than previous multi-gene studies, they should be viewed as preliminary because we've yet to complete our proposed more extensive taxon sampling involving multiple representatives of most of the convoluted families. Our most interesting results are for order Poales, for which we now have the most complete initial representation of families and for which previous views regarding relationships among component families were the most clouded. Our plastome data strongly support bromeliads as sisters to the remaining members of the order, with Typha and Sparganium sister to all others, and then Rapatiaceae, represented by Photara Phytum, sister to the remainder. This resolution of the early branching of Poales is the first with a strong statistical support. Note that the bromeliads and Joinvillea higher up in the tree in the green box have exceptionally low rates of sequence evolution, comparable to those for palms, while grasses and several other groups have exceptionally fast rates. And it's undoubtedly the combination of these very fast and very slow rates that has made resolution of relationships in the order so difficult in the past. Our data support Ecdiocoliaceae as being the sister of the grasses, followed by Joinvillea, followed by Flagellaria. Those together form the so-called graminids. Our data strongly support the Restiids, that is to say the families Restianaceae and Central Lepidaceae from the southern hemisphere, as being monophyletic and sister to the graminids. Surprisingly, our sequence data identify the Xyrids as paraphyletic with Abelboda of the Xyridaceae, the grass is sister to the graminids plus the Restiids, and then Myaca and Syngonathus of two additional families, sister to Abelboda, the graminids, and the Restiids. Finally, our data strongly support the monophyly of the Cyperids with Thurnia, sister to the sedges and rushes, and also supports their overall position, sister to the other three major clades of the order Poales. Now, the molecular phylogeny provides the first clear evidence of five independent origins of wind pollination in Poales, in Typha Sparganium, in the Cyperids, in the Restiids, in Ecdiocoliaceae, and in grasses, excluding the first two earliest divergent subfamilies. The remaining taxa, outgroups, and inferred ancestors are animal pollinated, as indicated by the hollow coating of the branches. Support for these five origins of wind pollination in Poales comes from the distinctive inflorescence structure characterizing each of the wind-pollinated groups, despite convergence on several other traits tied to wind pollination. As predicted by evolutionary theory, wind pollination in Poales shows a significant pattern of correlated evolution with small, visually inconspicuous, unisexual flowers that lack nectar and occur in open habitats based on phylogenetically structured analyses using Mark Pagel's program, Discrete. These patterns parallel those found recently by Friedman and Barrett across Monocots using similar analytical approaches, even though our phylogeny and character scoring, including that of wind pollination itself, differs from theirs and other recent authors. However, we found no significant pattern of correlated evolution between pollination mode and Daiichi. Probably for sampling reasons, it's found only in one family, Restinaceae, or ovule number. So why so many origins of wind pollination in Poales when origins of wind pollination are rare in other monocots? Wind pollination should evolve in open, windy, low diversity environments in species that are locally dominant in such habitats and microsites, and in areas that lack reliable animal pollinators. Many early divergent lineages in Poales occupy habitats kept open, as indicated by the golden line, by flooding or fire or extreme soil infertility. Bromeliads and Rapatiads occupy high diversity, open and closed habitats where wind pollination might be a liability. Xyrids are generally small plants that rarely dominate communities, so it's not surprising that they would not be wind pollinated. Two late divergent lineages, namely Ecdiocoleaceae and the so-called Pac-Mad-Bep clade of Poaceae, the upper grasses, if you will, reinvaded open habitats in areas kept open by extremely infertile soils and flooding, or by seasonal aridity or fire. I would propose that there should be four additional prime movers recognized that would favor the evolution of wind pollination in herbs. These include tall stature, vigorous vegetative spread, adaptation to patchy disturbances, say caused by fire or flooding, and positive feedbacks in the case of grasses due to fire or interactions with grazers or defensive fungal endophytes. All these could promote local dominance and hence wind pollination. The first three of these prime movers characterize all lineages that evolved or retained wind pollination in Poales, except for two small families, Ecdiocoleaceae and Cetrolepidaceae. Wind pollination in these groups may have evolved simply to assure reproduction in the harsh, windswept alpine habitats and extremely infertile, windswept or seasonally flooded microsites they occupy. Now, molecular analyses and comparative studies at lower taxonomic levels can provide a more detailed view of evolutionary patterns than you can see in some of the broad scale studies. And this is nicely illustrated by our work on the family Bromeliaceae. Bromeliads are, as you've seen, sister to all the members of Poales, and they're the third largest family of the order, with 58 genera and 3,200 species, including a large number of specialized growth forms, such as tank-forming species that impound rainwater, epiphytes, several myrmecophytes fed by ants, and indeed a few carnivorous species. Many have absorptive trichomes, or leaf hairs, that permit the uptake of water and nutrients via their leaves. Bromeliads have diversified extensively in pollinators with visitation by hummingbirds, insects, and bats being the most common. Bromeliads range from Virginia to Tierra del Fuego, with a single species in West Africa. Within tropical America, they have invaded the Guyana and Brazilian shields, the Andes, Central America, the Amazon basin, and the Caribbean. Bromeliads thus pose several questions at the interface of systematics, evolution, ecology, and geographic diversification. Where and when did they arise? Do natural relationships within the family support their traditional division into three subfamilies? What traits are correlated with the spread of bromeliads outside their area of origin? And what traits are associated with high net rates of species diversification? Answering these questions has been difficult due to the high degree of morphological homoplasy, essentially convergence, their extremely low rates of molecular divergence from each other. And in the past, the challenge posed in identifying their closest relatives, given their extensive divergence in terms of both molecules and form from all other groups of monocots. Traditionally, bromeliads have been divided into three subfamilies. The Picarnioidae with winged seeds, the Tillandsioidae with plumose seeds, and Bromeliordae with fleshy fruits. Over the past decade, several labs have used DNA sequence data to infer that this schema is inadequate because Picarnioidae, as originally described, is highly paraphyletic, even though it makes for great spears. Based on NDHF sequences and the widest taxon sampling to date, our group at the University of Wisconsin, including myself and Ken Seitzma, several of our students, proposed a 8 subfamily schema for the bromeliads, consistent with the patchwork of results from other labs and with describing as few subfamilies as possible while maintaining their monophyly and ease of morphological diagnosis. The green bar highlights members of the former Picarnioidae, as it was originally described, and illustrates its paraphyly relative to the Tillandsioids and the Bromelioids. This phylogeny provided a lot of insights into patterns of adaptive evolution and biogeographic spread, and provided also the first timeline for the family's evolution. But the NDHF phylogeny has a number of weaknesses, most notably its inability to resolve the branching sequence of the Hectioidae and Tillandsioidae, shown here in yellow and in blue, or in providing strong support for the position of Navioidae, shown in purple, and the recircumscribed Picarnioidae, shown in green. To test this new classification, clarify the branching order of the proposed subfamilies, and provide added insights into bromeliad evolution and patterns of geographic spread and rates of net diversification, we formed an international consortium of 9 labs in 6 countries to produce a multi-locus phylogeny for the family. Together, we have sequenced 8 rapidly evolving plastid genes and spacers, including 9,341 aligned characters for a total of 90 bromeliad species representing 46 of the 58 genera, as well as members of Rapadiaceae and Typhaceae, and we use date palm as the ultimate outgroup for polarizing the data. Maximum parsimony produced a well-supported, strict consensus tree with polytomies, as you can see mainly at the top in the subfamily Bromelioidae. Its subfamilial branching topology is fully resolved, generally well-supported, and consistent with that based on NDHF alone, but with Hectia now identified as sister to the clade consisting of subfamilies Navioidae, Picarnioidae, Puyoidae, and Bromelioidae at the top of the figure. The subfamilies are related, as you can see, in ladder-like fashion. Maximum likelihood and Bayesian analyses yield essentially the same tree, but as indicated in the inset, it turns out that Puya is resolved in those analyses as being paraphyletic. The Chilean species are sister to Bromelioids plus all other Puya. But the branches at the base of both Puya clades are very short, and a new study by Jabali and Seisman shows that including nuclear DNA sequences or morphological data support the monophyling of Puya. Now, within Bromeliaceae, the remarkable genus Burkinia, okay, let's not have a seizure here, there we go, forms the subfamily Burkinioidae, highlighted with the blue line at the bottom. It's a small clade of 20 species, sister to all other bromeliads. Burkinia is endemic to the Guiana Shield and nearly restricted to extremely nutrient-poor sands and sandstones atop the Tipuis, the flat-top sandstone mountains of Venezuela and adjacent countries, and also nearby sandplains. In response to the extreme nutrient poverty in these areas, Burkinia has undergone an adaptive radiation in mechanisms of nutrient capture unparalleled at the generic level in angiosperms, including tank-forming carnivores in the upper left, anthed myrmecophytes, next one over, let's keep on that page for a second. Epiphytes, Next one over, nitrogen fixers and ordinary terrestrial species that range from tiny rock-dwelling species a few centimeters tall to gigantic tree-like forms. Burkinia, with only 20 species, sister to all other 3,200 bromeliad species, and having evolved almost all mechanisms of water and nutrient capture found in the family as a whole, illustrates as graphically as possible why we should never, as some have proposed, define adaptive radiation solely in terms of the numbers of species in a clade relative to its sister group. Linnaeoidea is next on the bromeliad ladder, sister to all bromeliads except Burkinia. Linnaea and Canellia are terrestrial genera with non-impounding leaves, and they're also restricted to the Gaina shield. Tillandsioids, the subfamily most specialized for the epiphytic habit, including one-third of all species, diverge next. Most of the attacks occur in the Andes and in Central America. Next to diverge from the main bromeliad line was Hectia from Central America. This position is surprising because Hectia shares several drought-adapted leaf traits with four genera in two other subfamilies. Navioids are sister to the remaining bromeliads and include Cottondorfia from the Brazilian shield and Brucaria, Navia, and Sequentia from the Gaina shield. All are terrestrials with tough, non-impounding leaves. The recircumscribed Picernioidea includes Picernia, sister to a clade consisting of Fosterella and the highly xeromorphic genera Dickia, Ancillarium, and Deuteroconia. Picernia has over 400 species and it grows from sea level to high elevations in the Andes. Almost all the species are terrestrial. Fosterella occurs at intermediate elevations and Deuteroconia at high elevations in the Andes, while Dickia ranges from the Andes out to the Brazilian shield where it overlaps in the Horn of Brazil with Ancillarium. Puya is centered in the Andes, and several taxa bear spectacular iridescent flowers and immense terminal inflorescences. Puya consists, as we've seen, of two clades, one of mainly Andean species from higher elevations, and a second from low elevations in coastal Chile. Finally, the fleshy-fruited bromeliads, including the pineapple, are sister to Puya. The earliest divergent bromeliads are all small terrestrial genera, including Fascicularia, Gregia, and Ontogavia from low elevations in Chile, Bromelia from throughout South America, and Dinacanthon from the Grand Chaco, followed by Pseudonanus and Ananus, the bromeliads from the Brazilian shield. Almost all bromeliads sister to Acanthostachys and Cryptanthus, roughly halfway up in the bromeliad tree, are tank epiphytes that are restricted to the Brazilian shield. This clade accounts for 80% of all the bromeliad species and more than one-third of all bromeliads. To infer the dates of origin for Bromeliaceae and its subclades, we calibrated the monocot NDHF tree using the technique of penalized likelihood and the geological ages of six monocot fossils from the Cretaceous, and then employed the result ages of the bromeliad stem and crown groups to calibrate the eight locust tree. We inferred that bromeliads diverged from other monocots 100 million years ago, as you see on this slide, and that the extant genera began to diverge from each other slightly over 19 million years ago. 81 million years between the origin of bromeliads and their initial divergence into modern genera, I think, helps explain the great difficulty early researchers had in identifying the closest relatives of the bromeliads. Extant species of Burkinia began to diverge from each other 19 million years ago, before almost any of the modern bromeliad genera began to diverge from each other. That is to say, Burkinia's age is roughly comparable to the entire remainder of the family. And this, together with the extreme mineral poverty of the Gaina shield, may explain why the range of nutrient capture mechanisms in Burkinia almost equals that in the rest of the family. We used our phylogeny to reconstruct the biogeographic spread of the bromeliads using three approaches. First, maximum parsimony, which emphasizes the role of dispersal with the inferred ancestral distributions portrayed as the colors of the branches you see on this chronogram. Secondly, we use Bayesian inference, which emphasizes both vicariance and dispersal. In that case, the ancestral distributions are portrayed as the color or the colors of the small circles at each node. And then finally, S-diva, which emphasizes vicariance, that is, they spread through contiguous areas rather than long-distance dispersal, with ancestral distributions portrayed as the color or colors of the large circles at each node. These three approaches yield essentially the same picture of the origin and geographic spread of the family. Bromeliads arose on the extremely infertile sands and sandstones of the ancient Guiana Shield, shown here in dark blue, both on the key map and at the bottom, looking at the characteristic distributions of present-day taxa with those squares and the inferred distribution of ancestors with branch colors or the smaller, the colors of the small or large circles. After that, bromeliads began to spread rapidly into surrounding areas, beginning about 15.4 million years ago, with the Tillandsioids invading the northern littoral of South America, the Caribbean, and the Andes, which are shown here in yellows, oranges, and reds. The Navioids spreading throughout the Brazilian and Guiana Shields, shown again in dark blue. In the case of the Brazilian Shield in light blue. Later, you had the remaining subfamilies invading the Andes and subsequently the Brazilian Shield and some independent invasions of Central America all about 15 million years ago and ending about 10 million years ago. The ancestor of Bitcairnia feliciana arrived in West Africa only about 9 million years ago. That's indicated by the black branch and the black box in the middle of the figure. That implies that Bitcairnia got to West Africa via long distance dispersal, given that the Central Atlantic rifted about 90 million years ago. So movement by vicariance would have been impossible. Or very, very unlikely. No, impossible. No snorkels allowed in bromeliads. Bromeliads, or bromelioids, subfamily bromelioidae, arrived in the Brazilian Shield, remember, coated in light blue, and especially in the Atlantic forests and the tall inselbergs of the Brazilian highlands about 9 million years ago, apparently from the Chilean coast and the southern Andes, where several small, early divergent bromelioid genera are native, as is one important clade of closely related Puya. Climatic and geological reconstruction suggests that the Serra do Mar of south coastal Brazil, the so-called Brazilian highlands, was uplifted and became substantially more humid 5 to 10 million years ago. This corresponds with the origin of a very large clade of bromelioid tank epiphytes in this area at about that time. Thus, within a short period of just 1 to 5 million years, bromelioids spread rapidly beyond their area of origin on the sandstone tepuis and sand plains of the Guiana Shield throughout much of their modern range in the American tropics. And the lineages that account for almost all modern species arose, almost all the modern genera, or at least the subfamilies arose. This, what we call bromeliad revolution, involved the rise of several morphological and physiological traits that enabled bromeliads to invade dry or epiphytic or montane conditions that occurred while the northern Andes were being uplifted and thereby shunning the Amazon to its present course and dividing the Guiana and Brazilian shields from each other. Ancestors of at least three clades invaded the Andes at or about this time, including the Tillandsioids, the Pitcairnioids, and Puya. Now, CAM photosynthesis arose at least four times in Puya and Bromelioidae, in deuterocoenodichia and echolyrium, of the pit carinioidae in Hectia, and in certain species of Varizia and Tillandsia, the Tillandsioids. The rise of CAM opened a whole range of arid habitats and ephemerally arid epiphytic perches to bromeliads that were not available to the ancestral Burkinioids and Lindanioids. Tank formation arose at least three times in Burkinia in just one or two species, actually in five species, in Tillandsioids and in Bromeliads, sister to Acanthostachys. All gains of tank formation are associated with rain or cloud forests. In Burkinia, the tank habit appears to have risen as an adaptation to extreme mineral poverty under high rainfall and led to the evolution of carnivory and fed myrmecophily and nitrogen fixation. In other groups, the tank habit appears to serve as an adaptation for epiphytic life, especially in cloud forests and other areas with predictably heavy rainfall. And it's associated with the rise of water and nutrient absorptive trichomes and explosive speciation in Tillandsioids and Bromeliads. Epiphytism also arose at least four times in the same lineages as the tank habit, always in association with rainforest or cloud forest. None of the nine terrestrial genera at the base of the Bromeliads impound rainwater in a tank, while almost all of the remaining taxa, including more than 80% of all Bromeliads, are tank epiphytes endemic to the Brazilian shield. Bird pollination evolved at least twice in the Tillandsioids and in Pitcairnioidae, Poodoidae, and Bromeliidae about 15 million years ago, about the time when the two major Andean clades of hummingbirds arose, and associated with montane habitats where epiphytism and reliance on thermoregulating pollinators would be favored. Bat pollination arose at least three times, in each instance from ornithophily, from bird pollination, and associated with warm, humid conditions at lower elevations. The acquisition of tanks, absorptive trichomes, and avian pollination by several lineages roughly 15 to 12 million years ago during the Bromeliad Revolution would have handed Bromeliads the keys to the epiphytic kingdom and permitted them to expand from the Gynas Shield into several drier or more mountainous peripheral regions. The rise of epiphytism and phylogenetically correlated traits in Tillandsioids and Bromeliads should have greatly accelerated speciation in the two largest subfamilies by allowing the invasion of a new adaptive zone. I would argue, though, perhaps more important would be that the acquisition of these traits would have allowed invasion of and speciation in spatially extensive, topographically complex, climatically intricate mountain ranges, primarily in the Andes for the Tillandsioids and the more recently uplifted Serra do Mar in coastal Brazil. Such mountains favor the origin of epiphytism and related traits by increasing rainfall and humidity, but it may be that the mountains themselves favor high speciation rates more than epiphytism itself. Indeed, comparisons of Bromeliad subfamilies show that invasion of complex mountain ranges is by far, as indicated at the bottom of this table, the strongest correlate of the net rate of species diversification at the subfamilial level. That effect is followed in sequence by association with hummingbird pollination, which is also strongly associated with montane habitats. Finally, let me conclude by saying a few words about a new project we're beginning in my lab to reconstruct phylogeny and evolutionary patterns at even finer scales within the single genus Lilium, focusing on the 21 species of lilies native to North America. This is also a very old project, building on a thesis by one of my Harvard advisees in the early 80s before I came to Madison, based on hundreds of hours of floral observations and careful measurements of pollen loads. Mark Skinner found that our lilies are pollinated by three groups of animals. And these include hummingbirds, which pollinate six species, including Lilium bolanderi, Occidentale, Meridimum, and Columbianum in Western North America, and Canadense and Grayi in Eastern North America. Hummingbird pollinated lilies tend to have reddish tubular flowers, unscented and gently nodding, with anthers and style packed tightly around the floral axis. Butterflies, especially large swallowtails and danaids, are the main pollinators of 12 species, including 7 in eastern North America and 5 in the west. Butterfly pollinated lilies usually have a vertical orientation with either a pendant Turk's cap form with flaring anthers and style and a short floral tube, or an erect upward pointing cup in species Philadelphicum and Catesby down at the lower right. Most species have orange tepals with conspicuous dots. Pollen is transferred to the hind wing margins in butterflies visiting large flowers and to forewings or the body in those visiting smaller or upright lilies. Sphinx moths or hawk moths appear to be the principal pollinators of Parii, Washingtonianum, and perhaps Rubescens from Western North America. The first two have the largest flowers among the North American taxa, and all are lightly colored with spots absent or tiny. They're strongly scented at night, and they're often borne horizontally. Now, this floral diversity and the many similarities among species with that share similar pollinators, the divergence between species using different pollinators, naturally begs the question of whether each of these floral syndromes in North American lilies arose once or many times. And when Mark and I discussed this in the early 80s, we didn't have the molecular tools to address this question rigorously, but we realized we couldn't use floral characters to infer phylogeny and the pathway to different floral syndromes without fear of circular reasoning, of single origins for each syndrome, because the traits used to come up with the phylogeny were floral and likely subject to convergence under selection imposed by pollinators. It turns out that informative vegetative characters were mostly below ground and mostly involved bulb characters, but those diverged in species found on wet versus dry ground, and that made any phylogeny based on vegetative characters also suspect. I remember walking downstairs one day to find Mark to tell him to look at a paper just come out in PNAS, published by these guys I'd never heard of, Zamir and Palmer, and using chloroplast restriction sites, whatever they were, to reconstruct phylogeny. Alas, Mark was not interested. So I had to wait until arriving in Madison 2 years later, meeting Ken Seitzman, for us to develop a new approach for studying adaptive radiation rigorously using phylogenies based on molecular characters independent of the traits whose radiation is being studied. And a very fruitful collaboration on many other projects has ensued over the years. To unravel the enigma of the North American lilies, Mark and I joined forces with Ben Vennie to conduct a molecular systematic study of the North American lilies. We sequenced nuclear ribosomal ITS and about 8,200 aligned base pairs of 7 plastic genes and spacers for each North American species and subspecies. For 15 Eurasian species from all but one section outside North America, and for 2 members of Fritillaria, which Ronsted et al. Showed was sister to Lilium. Maximum parsimony produced 144 shortest trees, reweighting characters based on consistency, resolved 2 more nodes, and produced the strict consensus shown here. Bootstrap values are shown above each node. The North American taxa, including 2 species, form a monophyletic lineage with 100% bootstrap support. Philadelphicum and Catesbii, the species with the erect flowers, form another clade with 100% bootstrap support, embedded in one of 2 clades of Eurasian species. Within the main North American clade, it turns out that the eastern and western species form sister clades with 7 and 12 species respectively. The western species show a further split into a Klamath clade centered in the Siskiyou and Klamath Mountains along the California-Oregon border, and the Sierra clade centered in the Sierra Nevada, the transverse ranges and the coast ranges of western and southern California. Independent calibrations of RBCL and NDHF monocot trees by the group in Madison and by Winterston and Bremer in Sweden indicate that Fritillaria and Lilium diverged from each other 6 million years ago. And based on that, our data imply that the North American clade arose only 3.7 million years ago, about the age of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands, and that the eastern and western North American clades diverged 2 million years ago, and that the Klamath and Sierra clades diverged 1.3 million years ago, about the age of Maui in Hawaii, and that the eastern species began to diverge from each other 700,000 years ago, about the age of the Big Island in Hawaii. There is, however, significant conflict between the plastid and the nuclear data sets. The combined analysis fails, as you can see here, to resolve Cartellinum, Washingtonianum, and Humboldtii as monophyletic. Comparison of the plastid and the ITS majority rule trees, together with a consideration of morphology and geographic distribution, suggests that several hybridization or introgression events have occurred. For example, as you see on this slide, Kelagii, which is pictured at the bottom, is sister to Columbianum in the plastid tree on the left, it is closely related to Rubescens in the nuclear tree on the right. Alone among the butterfly pollinated species, Kelagii shares an unusual mauve tepal coloration with Rubescens and Washingtonianum, subspecies purpurescens. It shares small flowers and nodding form with Columbianum, and it's endemic to a small area where the ranges of Columbianum and Rubescens intersect. We therefore conclude that Kelagii is most likely a hybrid between these two species. As another example, Lilium grayi is a hummingbird pollinated species from the southern Appalachians, pictured in the middle. Morphologically, grayi is very similar to Lilium canadense. Essentially, its flowers are just redder, more tubular versions of canadensis. But our molecular data surprisingly show that grayi is a hybrid of canadense and superba, the Turk's cap lily from the south, both of which overlap at high elevations in high elevations in the Appalachians. Grayi shares unique secondary constrictions of several of the large acrocentric chromosomes with superba and at least one alternative state with canadense. Mark Skinner observed that grayi has pollen exene with low, smooth murai, seen in the top middle. This pattern is strikingly similar to that seen in the western hummingbird species Bolanderi and Meridimum, and quite different from the knobby murai seen in the butterfly-pollinated Pardalinum and Kelagii in the west and Meshoii in the east. These observations suggest that exine sculpturing, often viewed as essentially neutral by plant systematists, may in fact have adaptive value. Similar analyses show that 6 of the 21 North American species appear to be of recent hybrid origins. To update Matthew 6:28, the lilies of the field and forest toil not, nor do they spin, but they sure do screw around a lot. If we prune suspected hybrids from the combined data set, we obtain 3 shortest trees in the strict consensus shown. This tree implies that butterfly pollination is ancestral, that hummingbird pollination arose 3 times in eastern North America at the Sierra clade and the Klamath clade, and that moth pollination arose twice in the Klamath and the Sierra clades. Thus, except for the absence of moth pollination in eastern North America, lilies provide a beautiful example of parallel radiation in 3 geographically isolated areas. Now, just to say in conclusion here, we can get to the concluding part. We hope to submit a proposal soon with my postdoc, Mercedes Ames, to explore the system in greater detail. Given that even 8 plastid regions do not provide strong support or well-resolved maternal strict consensus, we plan to sequence the entire plastid genomes of all the North American taxa and several haplogroups, drawing lessons from our work across monocots and wringing as much phylogenetic information as possible from the maternally inherited chloroplasts. Given that it's quite difficult to analyze relationships in a system in which more than a quarter of all the species appear to be of hybrid origin, we plan to sequence several independently segregating nuclear loci. Here we plan to tap another lesson from the ATOL project. Sequencing the transcriptomes to date has produced alignable sequences of 232 nuclear genes across representatives of most of the orders, and several of these genes are known to have introns, and we plan to screen those and sequenced perhaps 8 or 10 for our analysis of reticulate evolution in Lilium. The resulting analysis will combine detailed knowledge of lily morphology, pollination biology, and biogeography with state-of-the-art sequencing and systematic techniques to provide, we hope, important new insights into the origins of the North American lily species, their adaptive radiation in floral form and habitat preference and pattern of geographic spread. Thank you very much. Now, it looks like we're just a couple of minutes past one. People have to leave, go for it. Otherwise, I'd be happy to field several questions from the floor. Andy.
You showed a slide of the vaults and mentioned that they seem to be
associated with
different environmental conditions.
Yes.
Do you see those morphologies arising multiple times in the
We haven't analyzed that yet. And also, there are a lot of autapomorphic characters, so we have to get down to a core set of 2 or 3 bulk characters. So there are below ground characters that could identify individual species but not clades. So the problem is the characters that are shared that are potential synapomorphies that converge in either dry or wet ground species. Yes?
Do you have any information about whether reproductive strategies like selfing versus outcrossing track with any of the phylogenies? I was thinking mostly about bromeliads.
I was going to say, actually for both, there's inadequate data. In the case of the lilies, it appears that the species, you have these pre-mating barriers in the form of different pollinators. Species with similar pollinators generally don't overlap spatially. In terms of outcrossing versus inbreeding in bromeliads, again, that's hardly explored. There's just not enough data to say. Yeah. Other question, but interesting question, no doubt. And if you were interested in pursuing such a project, it would be very interesting in either case. Thank you very much. And people interested in plant evolution, be sure to tune in tomorrow in the biology colloquium for Spencer Barrett's talk. Thank you.